Hey there, I'm Matt Walker, the host of the Choir Director Corner podcast. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. I'm so excited you are here. Before we dive in, I want to tell you about a one-of-a-kind online resource for choir directors, and it's called the Choir Director Corner Community Membership. This membership was designed to give you the training, the resources, the support, and the community you need to be successful in your teaching. Inside the membership, you'll find online courses, which will help you polish your current skills, as well as learn some new strategies and techniques, a PDF resource library with over 50 PDFs and Google Docs that you can use in your daily teaching and workflows, monthly collaboration calls where you can ask questions, get feedback, and collaborate with choir directors just like you, and access to our recommended repertoire videos and repertoire lists. There's even a private Facebook group, which gives you another place online to collaborate with other choir directors and ask questions. Being a choir director doesn't have to be a DIY endeavor. It's so much better when it's done together. So head on over to choirdirectorcorner.com/membership and join us in the Choir Director Corner community membership. There's even a 7-day free trial where you can get inside the membership and check it out. Again, that's choirdirectorcorner.com/membership. All right, on with today's episode. And hello, my friends, and welcome to the Choir Director Corner podcast. My name is Matt Walker. I'm your host. Thanks so much for stopping by and joining me for today's episode. And I'm super excited in today's episode to share with you my conversation with Paul John Rudoy. Now, if you don't know Paul, Paul is a professional singer, he's a conductor, and he's also a composer. And along with the amazing music that he is bringing into the choral world, he also has a couple of other projects that he is using to bring creativity and collaboration and also accessibility into the choral world as well. So I talked to him about how he became a composer, all of his music background, his compositional process, and really kind of his philosophy behind composing choral music, and then a couple of these other amazing projects that he has going on that are really doing wonderful things for our choral community. So let's get right into it. Here is my conversation today with Paul John Rudoy. Well, I'm very excited to welcome Paul John Rudoy to the podcast. Paul, thank you so much for being with me here today.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
So for those in our audience that are a little maybe not as familiar with your work, tell us a little bit about your background, your education, your musical experiences. You're really a what I call a choral renaissance man here. So tell our audience all the, about all the stuff that you do.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I started singing right out of the womb. So I just sang constantly. My mom sang me to sleep instead of reading to me, which I think was actually really formative. And then I joined a children's choir. The American Boy Choir came to my area in Florida, where I was living, and I wanted to be a part of that. Apparently so much so that I decided I would audition while they're there. And I checked the mailbox every day for whether or not I got in. And I was lucky enough to get in. And that was my formative middle school experience. My brother, who's also a vocalist, also went to the American Boy Choir. And sadly, it's no longer around, but it was such an important experience. I now love sight reading and learning new music as a direct result of 1 to 3 hours a day of sight reading and rehearsing. So that was crucial. Then in high school, I continued to sing in a variety of community choruses and all states and that sort of thing. Went to college at the Hart School in Hartford, Connecticut. And it was a really wonderful, well-rounded conservatory education. I got my degree in voice, but luckily my mentor, Dr. Ed Bolkovac, reminded me that getting a degree in your hobby means that you also need to make sure that you have ideas for how to make money and make a living.
That's sort of important. Yeah, yeah.
It was crucial, yeah. And luckily it kind of hit home around junior year. So I had about a year before I was out on my own. and I sent in materials to Contus, not even knowing that they were a full-time ensemble at the time. I just know that my boy choir, the American Boy Choir, sang with them when they were in college and I was in middle school. And then luckily they had an opening in 2008. So I joined them and was there for 8 years, kind of trying a bunch of different hats. That's where I started to compose officially and educate. I didn't have an education degree, so I learned on my feet. And we can talk more about that. I find that experience in the field, trying things that you're not comfortable with yet in music, is a crucial way to round out your education beyond just being book smart in music. So that said, I wanted to get more book smart. So I left Contus in 2016, went to go get a master's with Dr. Sharon Paul and Professor Keir in composition and conducting over in Eugene at the University of Oregon. I ended up with just one degree because I was taking a variety of gigs and realized that I didn't have a 5-year plan, only a 2-year plan for a degree. But the choral conducting degree really helped round out what I was getting a lot of experience in Contus. And then since then, I've done a wide variety of things. Obviously, since then, a pandemic happened, which has been really difficult. But as a result, and we'll talk more about this, I feel like that helped offer some sort of a reset button for many people in music. Some people have left to pursue other fields. And I actually am less sad about that than I have been since the pandemic started. And we can kind of talk about that. I feel more hopeful. It's not because they're out of the field, but because you only have one life to live. And to consider that if you've been a musician for a decade or two and you transition to another field, it's not like you're no longer ever going to do music. Actually, some of the benefits are potentially being a volunteer musician, but a good one. That's always a wonderful thing. So
right.
I've also been composing larger works primarily, but also some octavos. And now I conduct, I should say right out of the pandemic, I conducted the St. John's Boys Choir for a year. It was a really interesting time, and then I moved on to what I currently do, which is marketing and communications with the National Lutheran Choir. And I also conduct the chorale at Meeting House Church in Edina, Minnesota. And then I also sing professionally with a couple different groups, primarily True Concord down in Tucson, where I went to high school. So it's a full circle moment. So, but I agree that I guess I would be considered a Renaissance person, but really I find that this is just a trajectory that is the 21st century choral musician. And we can talk more about that as well.
Absolutely. So I'm just trying to figure out like how there are 30 hours in your day. Like the length of your days must be longer somehow in order to just fit all of those amazing things in. So that's terrific. But I agree with you what you're saying. You know, life is too short to be doing something that you're just not super passionate about. And like you said, you know, it doesn't always have to be your profession. There are other ways that you can experience music and contribute to musical ensembles while, as you said, still, you know, doing something else that allows you to make a living too. So absolutely. Mm-hmm. So you talked a little bit about this, I think, but talk about when you first started composing. Was that with your time with Contus or was it before then?
It's a great question. So I vaguely remember composing a lot of music before I joined Contus. So this was in my undergrad. And even in high school, I very vividly remember my first piece. I do not have it. I don't even remember what the text was. But it was for TTBB. And it was me and three friends, and in Tucson at our high school, we premiered it on a choir concert, a bunch of suspended fourths moving down by step. And then I wrote more pieces that sounded a lot like Eric Whitaker, in college, but then I started to expand, into art song. Even early on, it occurred to me that I should write for what I have available to me. because it gives me an excuse to try things. And if they aren't good, I don't ever have to do them again, or I don't need anyone to see them. Right.
Right.
And unlike being a vocalist, I don't have to show anything until I'm ready to show it.
Right.
Right. So that was a great contrast to what I was primarily doing in my undergrad. But I also just find it interesting because I don't remember ever having a moment where I said, I'm going to write music. You know, I think I just came back from my choir rehearsals or my voice lessons thinking, man, this is some really good music. I do not understand why it's so good. Like, why is this art song stuck in my head? Is it the melody or is it the harmony? You know, or why we did Brahms' Alto Rhapsody 1 year, which was amazing because I had never done TTBB repertoire other than that quartet, I guess. And I just was amazed at how good the piece was, but I didn't know why. So I just used it as a way to decompress from my day to day, which it tells you just how much I wanted to just soak up music.
Right. Yeah.
Instead of doing video games, I was just analyzing other music. But I just was writing a lot, I think, just to explore what that was like or imitate, you know. So by the time my senior year came around in voice, when I had my recital, I decided, I'm pretty sure my junior year, I decided to write a trio song cycle, three-piece song cycle for myself and piano, to explore if I could do it. I had backup pieces. I assumed that it wasn't going to be good enough. And then the more I honed in on these three pieces, the more I realized that they were good enough that I would at least show them publicly. And now those are the first three of a six song cycle called The Child of the Heartless Wind, that's available on Graphite Publishing. So that was my first foray. But once I got into Contus, that's when things really started to take off. Not because they they thought I was a good composer. Actually, I apparently had enough confidence that I sang one of my pieces for my audition for Contus.
Oh, wow.
Because I already knew that even if it wasn't that great, it would showcase that I was willing to take a risk and try something new. And I stated that in my audition. And so when I got in, you know, it's 8 to 9 tenors and basses looking at thematic and narrative programming.
Mm-hmm.
So you can think about how difficult it is to program an entire concert. There were often holes to be filled, but maybe we had a text or we had an idea of what the piece in this hole might sound like or feel like. And that to me was a fun exercise because I trusted these guys to Man. Tell me if a piece was not good or how we could fix it, because it's a artist-led model. So we were all in the room making the best we could out of every piece. So I said, you know, I'll write this arrangement, or I'll try my hand at writing an original piece for this slot. So when it came into rehearsal, I had 8 of my friends being completely honest with me about, well, this really doesn't work to me. And I said, okay, how can we make it better? You know? So it was really just like, I learned to write for my friends and for the people around me and learn from that experience. It was very rarely personal to me. I tried to always take it as an educational moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What a wonderful opportunity. It comes to mind like a scientist lab where you going in and just doing experiments. Like, what an amazing opportunity to go in and create an experiment. And like you say, just like troubleshoot, but in an environment where, you know, where it's supportive and encouraging. Like you said, you know, you didn't take things personally, but at the same time, you know, you all were good enough colleagues where they were going to be honest with you too. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was, I should also say that it can't downplay enough, or you can't say enough of the narrative programming concept, because it's not like, here's a concert of British Isles music, and then you just do three composers and it's all just nice, you know, or whatever. You know, you could put a Bach piece next to a Dave Matthews arrangement because they both have death in common, or they have new life in common, or something, some sort of human narrative story element. And as a result, you know, I was 22 singing music from every genre, nearly every genre, nearly every era. I mean, and I was a sponge at that point. So of course, like, instead of my music consistently sounding like Eric Whitaker, within a couple of years of, you know, writing, I was digesting all this stuff at the same time. And as a result, as my mentor at in Oregon, Sharon Paul, I remember her saying, you know, your music is so interesting because I never know it's yours. Which is both a compliment and kind of scary, because to me, it's very exciting. It means that I'm going at it from every piece is its own entity, and it could be completely different. But it also means that I don't have necessarily a branded sound. Mm-hmm. And while, you know, I will never be Eric Whitaker or Jake Ronestad or somebody like that, I think, because my catalog is so wide ranging, I'm proud of a lot of the pieces because they all focus on their own meaning behind them and how they might connect with the pieces around them. And that's a result of this narrative programming model in Contus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think that's a great compliment, because it just shows how dedicated you are to whatever that initial idea of that piece is, and just, you know, trying to create music that brings that to life, rather than, you know, someone who's just kind of pulling from their toolbox of compositional tools that they use. Not, you know, not that that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think your dedication to each piece being unique and serving whatever that idea is, that's a wonderful thing. Well,
that's
talking about, yeah, right. So talking about compositional process, and you've kind of talked about how yours has evolved through the years. What does that typically look like now? And obviously, you know, with each piece, it's going to differ, kind of like what you know, were just talking about. But tell us a little bit about what you like to do as far as your compositional process and you know, structure and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it definitely has transitioned over the years, partly because I was learning on the job, you know, rather than I didn't have a lesson in composition, really. I had a couple lessons with Libby Larson, who was in town in the Twin Cities.
Mm-hmm.
But there were two, and it was mostly conversations about what I could do to improve my general knowledge base. So it really wasn't until 2016, when I went for that double master's, when I started the double master's, working with Robert Keir, that I had official lessons in it. And so I was going off of what I knew. So to start with, I knew Eric Whitaker in high school.
Right.
And so, you know, and this is not a knock at him at all, but what I knew from that music were chords, were a lot of notes in chords, because his most well-known pieces, which, by the way, are a very limited look at his catalog. The Stolen Child is an incredible piece that's rarely done because it's difficult, but it's absolutely different from Water Night and Sleep, the pieces that everyone knows. But at the time, I saw these chords. So a lot of my early pieces are homophonic, and I just went off the chords and found texts from that. But now it's the complete opposite. I find a text that I want to set, or I'm commissioned to write a setting of a text, and I'll speak it until it starts to tell me its rhythm and or its harmony. What I like to tell a lot of people now is that when we speak, we sing, and when we sing, we speak. We're using the same mechanism, just in a different way. But also, we are musical in nature. We are musical in nature. Ba-da-ba-ba-da, ba-ba-da, ba-da-ba-ba-da, ba-ba-da, right? It all transitions into music. It's just how we think about it. Rarely is there somebody who decides to talk like this all the time, and there's not much that we can do about it. It's kind of aggressively just monotone. It doesn't, that we don't talk like that, right? In fact, if we want to get something across, we speak in a more musical way, like a TED talk, so we can have a very clear picture of what someone is thinking and feeling, right? So those are all the phrasing I just did, although it's like it's overdone. That's really kind of the phrasing that we use when we think about art song, or ideally choir, band, orchestra. Like the good performances are musical in pacing. So I'll speak a text until it starts to sing to me. And lately, over the past 5 years or so, I guess the second half of my time composing, I've been using vocal DJ loop stations to loop myself. I was realizing that I was speaking it differently almost every time, which made it kind of complicated for me to like write it down. But then once I recorded myself looping it in a way, or I recorded myself in a way that made sense to me in terms of the phrasing, then I would record myself saying that, and then I would listen to that recording like a Philip Glass, you know, Steve Reich, whatever, tape. And over time, it would just teach me what its phrasing was. And then I would find out that that's in a 3-4 pattern, roughly, or a 5-4 pattern, or a 4-4 pattern, or whatever. And then from there, I would think, okay, well, what's a melody, a harmony and or melody that would be nice to fit in there? That would be nice to fit in there. Ba-da-ba-bum, ba-da-ba-bum, you know, something like that.
Sure.
That would lead me to the key center, generally. That would lead me to the cell that I could expand the whole piece around. But then in the middle, about 5-6 years ago, I started realizing that I could just print off the text and just stare at it and read through it a lot and find the key words or the key phrases or even the key syllables that I wanted to kind of hone in on, and I would circle them, make connections with them. Maybe they would rhyme, right? And then I would bring a word back from the beginning after we've gone through a 3-minute, 4-minute piece so that word means something different having gone through that journey, you know, something like that. So these are all different ways that I approach my current writing. I will say that one of my favorite pieces in my catalog, Song of Sky and Sea, A Song of Realization, was originally written for Contus, and I wrote it almost entirely on my loop station, as in I actually did not, you know, use it as a cell-based thing and then start writing it down. I realized that if I, you know, could just write entirely on my looper and listen to something and then organically think up a harmony to the melody that I put down. My looper also records 3 hours of material on each of its 5 tracks. So I had basically unlimited amounts of recording available to me. That resulted in a piece that to me sounds a pretty unique. It's all based in loops and canons and that sort of thing. But because I wasn't correcting myself, quote unquote, on a piano, I just kind of went with whatever harmonies I was obsessed with at the time, which because of valiatormis, doing a lot of valiatormis in Contus led me to 6-4 chords for tenors and basses. You know, having this fifth in the low note really made the chord ring a lot. Mm. And then I added a fourth under that. So ba 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 na, ba ba. That is like my favorite chord ever. So it all came back to chords, I guess.
Yeah.
Full circle.
Yeah, absolutely. So here's sort of a question about process. So you're really going from the sound perspective, well, starting with text and then sort of the sound perspective. So then how do you go about then getting that onto paper or onto a computer screen? So do you like to compose with old school pencil and staff paper, or is there software that you use to then sort of come up with your finished project, which will then, you know, in turn, you know, be the edition that ends up on Graphite Publishing? You know, what does that process look like?
Absolutely. Yeah. So usually, with the exception of Song of Sky and Sea, most other pieces, I'll basically take these cells and distill them down to their essential elements. So if I take a phrase that may have been spoken, I take a phrase that's spoken. I take a phrase that's spoken. Ba 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 ba. Right? That's really difficult rhythmically to put down on paper exactly as it is. But if I figure out the essential, what is close enough, but also fairly easily readable, really, it's just a bunch of eighths, right?
Right.
So I usually find somewhere in between that. If it's all a bunch of eighths, sometimes it become a little bit notey. So I might go ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, which is, you know, dotted eighth, 16th kind of thing. Or I could go ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. That's a triplet in there, right? So it just depends on how I try to find that that middle ground. And I've gotten better about asking people outside of my brain what is readable, what is accessible, right? Because I might think that a triplet is easy, but, you know, the way that I phrase is not the way someone else phrases. So I need to find that middle ground. And luckily, we can say a lot of things in different ways. We can say a lot of things in different ways. We can say a lot of things in different ways, right? So it's not necessarily a wrong versus right. It's what is feasible for a teacher instructing their choir, right? I want to make sure that it is accessible. Otherwise, they'll never perform it, right? So once I figure out what that distilled version is, then I might write it down on paper, just the rhythms. And then I go to the melody, think, you know, what would a good melody for this be, leading to certain phrases or certain syllables within that ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Maybe that goes higher on each of those moments. Maybe it goes lower in each of those moments. But once I have usually a two out of three, rhythm and harmony, rhythm and melody, harmony and melody, then everything starts to fall into place. And that's when I turn to finale. I will say I am not a fan. I think finale has always had a ton of bugs. And I'm not, you know, I'm not a programmer, but I will say I use Dorico. I'm learning Dorico slowly but surely. Seems more intuitive. I know Sibelius is more intuitive, but sorry, finale, just have to say that out loud. But I will say that because I've used finale over the years, it's a good way to get it down on paper. And you know, like ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, that's a 4-4 pattern with, you know, a rest at the end. So then I put that into finale and I just kind of figure the rest out as I go. So
Yeah. I'm a finale person as well. And I definitely, I would definitely agree with everything that you
I mean, finale and Sibelius brought us into this world. So I can't complain, but you know, MuseScore being free, Note Flight being completely online, Dorico being completely reimagined from the ground up. I think we're in the next 10 to 20 years we're going to see a huge shift in the way that we think about, do we have to deal with things or do we actually have to fix them, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. I've actually been using MuseScore the past six, seven months and just doing some basic things with it. And it's very user friendly. You know, it's just, you know, it just all kind of makes sense how it works. You know, rarely do I have to go, you know, through Google to to troubleshoot some sort of issue. Like everything is easy to find, unlike finale, where I've lost probably a couple of years on my life trying to figure things out with that. So before I get to the next point, I just wanted to say, you know, that whole thing that you talked about with your compositional process, when you combine that with your knowledge of the voice, I think those two things together, to me, is, you know, having been through a couple of your pieces, is what makes them, you know, such a cool experience from a musical perspective, but also at the same time, very accessible. You know, I'm teaching high school students. Some of them are very beginning students, you know, and, you know, I can't always say with different pieces where sometimes it's really cool, but it's not always that accessible. And then sometimes it's very accessible, but it's not something that the students are really into or can really relate to. But I have found that your music, the pieces that I have been through, are a great combination of both. And so that's just one of the things.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that makes your work just so magical. So now, speaking of your choral library. I know you're working on some pieces right now. So what are one, maybe two, if you can't limit it to one? I know it's like when kids ask me, oh, who's your favorite child? Well, I can't pick just one. what's one or maybe two pieces that you are working on currently that you're really excited about?
Yeah, well, I actually just finished fairly recently a piece for, I should say, Minnesota has a phenomenal support system for the arts and new music. They have a new commission every year for the Allstate Men's Choir. I'm pretty sure it's every year or it's every other year. And so I just finished the second of those. I wrote one a while back called Dangerous Man or Dangerous Men. But this most recent one, once I got the commission, I was thinking a long time about, it was also delayed for a year because of COVID.
Sure.
And so I had a little bit more time to think about the text that I wanted to set and that sort of thing. And I came back to what I'm pretty sure was my favorite poem in high school, which was Gary Soto's Oranges. And I don't know if you know that, but it's a phenomenal little poem about, from the perspective of, I'm assuming from the perspective of Gary, but I'll talk a little bit about this, why this was important. But I thought it was from the perspective of a boy going to pick up a girl for a date at a convenience store getting candy. And he brought two oranges with him. And he didn't have enough money for the candy. So he put down a nickel and an orange and set them quietly on the counter. And then the lady knew what it was all about. So they apparently got their candy and she opened the chocolate. It was December. And then he opened the orange. And at the end, I'll never forget it, reading it for the first time. It says, "And I opened the orange that was so bright against the gray of December that from some distance, someone might have thought I was making a fire in my hands." Such a cool image, right?
Yeah.
So I decided I would set that. And amazingly, this is just a reminder to everybody, doing a Google search on anything sometimes gives you great results. For instance, I just searched Gary Soto, came up to his website, and I was like, I wonder if he has his contact information. And sure enough, at the bottom was his phone number, not just his email, but his phone number. And I thought, that can't be his phone number. Like that's, that doesn't exist in the 21st century. So I called it and Gary picked up and we had a conversation, and that's how I got the rights to set, or got his permission to set the piece. But what was interesting was that while I was setting it, while I was thinking about how I was going to set it, I realized that it would be contrived no matter how I built these phrases. And also that the more I read it, I'm now 36. When I first read the poem, I was thinking, oh, this is cute about like two middle schoolers. And now setting it, or now thinking about it, it's, to me, it's very clear that this was an adult thinking back on a really important memory to them. So I realized that I had to set this in a very unique way. I had to have a soloist in the center, and everyone else in the choir was kind of this, this atmospheric, you know, common ground behind it, as if it was one memory that is being filtered through one soloist. And then it took me a while, but I finally figured out that I would have the soloist kind of lead these moments. And then when it became too much to remember, became emotional, they wouldn't sing. The choir would. They would just stand there and take it all in, the memory of this moment, you know? And then it all made sense once I realized that I don't have to have the choir singing the whole time, nor the soloist. So the vast majority of it is spoken. And then when it gets too emotional, the choir sings and the soloist stands and acknowledges this memory in the moment. So it hasn't been premiered. It's going to be in August, I think. And the last bit was me realizing that this doesn't, if it's mostly spoken and it's for TTB chorus, why can't it be for SSA? Here I am assuming that it's a man, a boy and a girl, when there's no indication of gender from the first person. So I'm sitting there thinking like, oh my gosh, this could be for SSA and TTB. it might have been written for a TTB ensemble, but it could just be for SSA as well. So I changed it after I sent them the final version. I was like, this is for three equal voice choir. So should be
love
fun.
It. Love it. So in August, you said that one's going to be premiered?
Yeah, it'll be at the, I can't remember, it's in my email somewhere, but I believe it's sometime in August when they'll premiere it, and then they'll have another performance in the spring. So we'll see.
Okay.
It'd be fun.
And that one's going to be on Graphite Publishing?
I think so. You know, we'll get to it when we get there, because I realize that one of the things, and I will just mention this in case any young composers are listening, the most important thing you could do, rather than sending in a piece with a MIDI rendering or something, is to get a performance, even if it's not a perfect performance, but it gets across the piece. That performance or that recording of your friends and you performing it is really useful, because it proves to the publisher that it can be done.
Right.
So once this happens, and I believe that it works the way I hope it will, then I'll send it to, you know, Graphite, or I'll self-publish it or something.
We'll sure. See. Absolutely. Well, I'm already sold. So as soon as it's available, you promise that you will email me and let me know.
I absolutely will. Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Because I'm already sold. That sounds sounds wonderful. So along with your singing and conducting and composing, you've got a couple of other projects that I wanted to talk about with you. The first one is called the Consortio Project. So talk to us a little bit about what is the Consortio Project, how did it come about, and then maybe most importantly, where choir directors can find out more information about this project.
Absolutely. Well, I'll say right away, it's Consortio EO.
Oh.
We wanted the website consort.io, but then, you know, of course with websites nowadays, you have to spend a ton of money if somebody already owns it. So we have consortio.io. That's our website. And way back when, at the tail end of my time with Contus, I was talking to my best friend, Tim Takash, who is a fellow composer, over the phone while I was on tour. And he was talking about how he was doing a consortium, which, for anybody who is curious, the traditional model is that one entity commissions a new piece of music. But usually that's pretty expensive. So you can go the other route, where you have a number of different organizations or choirs or bands or orchestras or whatever pool their resources together to pay the composer what they're worth, but also have a lower cost to the people who are commissioning. But he was doing this with, I can't remember how many members, not too many, but he was talking to me about how he was spending all his time doing logistics and hounding people for payments and things like that, when he really just wanted to write the piece. And it occurred to me right then and there that there should be, I asked him if he had done Kickstarter or Indiegogo, and he said, yeah, it doesn't really work because they've got a lot of red tape having to do with purchase orders and things like that. And then he also wanted to stay in touch with them in an easy way. And so he basically outlined all the things that Consortio was trying to fix. And so what we did was we basically created a crowdfunding website and a marketplace, which made it possible for composers to put up ideas for pieces that had not yet been written. And then directors go through that marketplace to find pieces that fit their ensemble, but also their timeline. You know, if the piece is going to be funded by June of 2023, then the composer writes it in the summer, has it be available to the members by August 2023. And then if that works with the fall programming that you or another director want to do, and you like Tim's music, then you can sign up for a slot in that consortium project. And what we were trying to achieve was not only making it easier in that way, just logistically, but also that payment processing is a lot easier. You know, you have purchase order and invoicing abilities that are pretty quick. If you don't have it automatically to you, it's within a business day, instead of sitting here trying to figure out or hound people for their payments. Also, it protects people in case composers don't provide the score in time. you know, it's important that you get the score. If you assume that you're going to be starting rehearsals on it in August, but you don't get it till November, that's a problem. You have to go back to your drawing board for programming. So we wanted to try to accomplish a lot of different goals, specifically in music, and at least to start, specifically in the choral field. I will say that the difficulty has been that, you know, we're a small enterprise, so we don't have a ton of money for marketing. And so getting it off the ground has a lot to do with just letting people know that it exists. And it's really interesting. We've had Ole Yelo through Chorus America all the way down to some brand new, wonderful composers that are up and coming from Portland to Maine and everywhere in between. And it's been an exciting process. I think it's a slow moving thing, as any new business is, and that is okay. It also doesn't help that there was a pandemic the past 2 years.
Yeah, it probably didn't help things. Yeah.
You know, but we're not really in it to make money as much as we are to change the game, because the reality is we don't live in a system where, you know, in the past, a commissioning was built on the idea that some rich person can hire someone to make music that they deem important. And while I don't feel that we are in a situation where people who are commissioning feel that they're important when they commission, they are defining what is and isn't valuable by doing so, because it's still expensive, right? The vast majority of directors don't even think about commissioning, because they know it's going to cost, let's say, $1,000 to $5,000 a minute. That's an insane amount of money when you can't even afford a full, you know, New Year's worth of new music. So if you can drop that amount down to $100 to $500 per buy-in, and you still, you know, reach a funding level where the composer is getting paid what they're worth, but then you also get this experience of working with the composer, as they're thinking up, as they're ideating the piece, you've got an experience here that a lot of up and coming musicians might not realize exists. You know, you hear people in the top 40 on the radio doing new music, but you don't experience that in the same way in a classical realm. And so this would be a great way to kind of bridge those gaps.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a fantastic project on a number of levels. I mean, it helps to support composers, which is so important. It gives conductors and programs that maybe wouldn't have that access, that opportunity, you know, to, you know, bring a new piece of music to their singers, and also have that opportunity to work in a collaborative way with the composer too. I mean, I think that's, to me, in the times I've been able to do that, I think that's the most fun part of the process, is getting to really collaborate with those composers and to have our singers really see what that process is like. Like, I have students that have gone on to, you know, study music at the university level, and they point to those experiences. Just like, that was such a cool experience. That made me want to make music, or to sing, or to perform, or whatever it is.
Or to compose. So, I mean, yeah. here's the thing. Like, I was in the American Boy Choir School. We were given a piece by Libby Larson, of all people. And it was, I can't remember the exact title, something like, A Bunch of Ways Why I Love, or A Bunch of Reasons Why I Love the Harmonica. And I was given it to learn, and I assumed it was finished. And then we were given a quote unquote final draft after. And that was when it occurred to me that this person was alive. I had been reading and assuming that all this music was by dead people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was 12 or whatever. It's just like, the sooner we can get people to think that you can be creative in the moment. I mean, at Bob Ross, right? Like, I mean,
right.
The more we can get people to think creatively, or not forget that they're creative as adults, the more, I mean, imagine how many brilliant minds haven't considered maybe writing music, but mm-hmm. they absolutely could if they understand how to go about the process, which I've talked before. It's like, I wasn't a composer. Not really, not officially. I just realized that you could distill music down to its essential elements, textures, you know, shapes, things like that. Anybody can do that. it's just a matter of giving people opportunity to think that way, and then giving them the tools to think that way.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. We were lucky enough in a previous program to premiere a piece, and I think it was 5-6 months later, one of the singers in my choir, he came to me and he's like, "Oh, well, I figured if that person can do it, maybe I could do it too."
Yes. Right?
And I was like, yes. And so
cool.
Yeah. And so we took his piece and like we sang through it as a choir, and we all kind of gave him some feedback. And he was a kid that went on to, you know, study music at the college university level. So yeah,
awesome.
So what a wonderful project. So I will make sure that I put a link in the show notes to that so people can find that consortio.io.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we're not quite done yet because you have another project, another project on top of project. Again, I don't know how you have 30 hours in the day. I only have 24 in mine, and I have to sleep.
Oh my gosh.
I have to sleep for at least 8 of those. So talk to me about this idea of creative literacy. We've talked a little bit about this sort of, outside of this conversation, something that you are very passionate about. And so, you know, what is sort of this idea of creative literacy, and what types of exercises or projects are you involved with that are sort of related to this topic?
Absolutely. Well, I should first say that that's not my term. I was talking with a friend, Scott Jarrett, about generally what this is. And he mentioned it to me that he had talked to some friends about it as well. And they kind of came up with that term, or they heard it from somebody else. So I think it's a great encapsulation of what I'm really passionate about. And I should say this ties in really well with Consortio. Mm. Because it's not just offering people an opportunity to experience new music, but it's the acknowledgement that you don't need to put composers on pedestals. They're people just like you.
Right.
And you have the capacity to think this way. You know, if you've ever painted, if you've ever been in a sandbox as a kid and made a castle, like the way that our brains are so brilliant, and they're brilliant in their own small and universal and big way. Everybody's a little bit different. And so, you know, if everybody wrote a piece of music, it would all be different. And so the idea behind creative literacy is giving people tools from where they are to think creatively about where they are. From my part, the creative literacy clinics that I lead, they're specifically choral related. So I'll come in with my vocal DJ loop stations and connect them to the speaker system and that sort of thing. And generally the process goes that I will warm the choir up, and then I will deconstruct those warm-ups. You know, if you go ba-da-ba-ba, ba-da-ba, and we sing, you know, I love to sing, and we go through our warm-ups up and down, that sort of thing. I will then record myself singing, I love to sing. And then I'll record over that going, I love to sing. And then I'll record another one, go, I love to sing, you know. And it will show that it's not a matter of one line. It's a matter of a texture. That's an example of different amounts of time creating a vocal texture. Or in the case of my loop station, if you want to create, you know, harmonies and you don't have a piano around you, you can just use your phone or a loop station if you have it, and just loop yourself on one note, think of another note, add that note, think of another note, add that note. There are no wrong answers.
Right.
You do not have to choose do, mi, so. You could choose do, re, fa, ba, 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 you know, whatever. And you create a texture, which happens to be all vertical, aka a chord. And so once people realize that it really is just a matter of textures in music, then you can make any number of textures. You know, I like, as an example, I like to use Bach because all of his music was very horizontal in nature. You know, every line is a lot of melodic phrasing up and down, you know, that sort of thing. But then you have these chorales that are very vertical, you know, in nature. But the more you spend time with the horizontal moments, you realize that they all do line up. You know, they are all in a key. And at any one moment, you can find a chord that also fits in with, say, those chorales later on. So it's a combination of horizontal and vertical. So I deconstruct what these warm-ups mean for the choir. And for all choirs, we all do warm-ups so that we have that in common, just like we have creativity in common. Yeah. So it's breaking down, ideally, the goal is that we're breaking down these walls to creativity. We're reminding ourselves that we can be creative. And in my opinion, and actually Dr. Sharon Paul and I from Eugene, we often joke because we have this ongoing disagreement. She believes that not everybody can be a composer.
Mm.
And I definitely understand, and she has valid points for that. I think deep down in my soul, everybody actually is a composer. We just need to offer the opportunities and the tools for people to be able to think that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's giving them just enough tools to sort of get them started, but also not hinder that creativity. I had a music theory teacher in college that said, well, you know, music theory is important to learn as far as composing goes, because you learn all the rules so that you can go forth and break them.
Mm-hmm. Bach is a great example. He broke the rules on a regular basis.
Right, right. And so it's giving them sort of that in those initial like fundamentals and structure, and then it's just like, okay, no, don't worry about the rules. You know, go, like you said, go into the sandbox, use whatever tools you want. You can pick whatever you want and just go and create. And
yeah. And I will say that there's a time and a place to follow the rules. You know, if you're in rehearsal and somebody says, well, I don't want to do that melody. Well, if you're a tenor, I know you have an ego because I have one, but but if our goal is to sound good together and the tenors have that melody right now, you should probably sing that, right? But it's also just breaking down, it's becoming aware of what's a norm and what doesn't have to always be a norm, right?
Yes.
Consortio,
yes.
It doesn't always have to be that people only with money get to experience what a commission is, right? It doesn't have to be. We live in the 21st century. We're not in the 17th, 18th century anymore, right? Another project that kind of ties in with this creative literacy thing, you know, I created a series of nonsense pieces, and nonsense music has been around for generations. You know, there are cultures around the world who have folk music that has nonsense syllables and that's passed down from generation to generation. You know, a recent good example from my friend Jake Runestad, Nyan Nyan, that's a nonsense piece, just a pseudo-yoik, Jaakko Mantjärvi's piece.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to add to that canon by creating a series of nonsense pieces, but I wanted to do something different with it. You know, when we think of published music, the idea is that it's fixed, right? When you see a piece of music in front of you, you're like, I gotta do that piece justice by following what's in the score. And you can make changes as a director or as a singer if you decide that we should take a breath here to make it more musical or for whatever reason. That's fair. That's an interpretation. But I get annoyed with the idea that there's kind of a lack of creativity in just following a score. It's like the composer, and you know, plenty of reasons why a composer should say, I want it done this way, because they know what will sound best. But for me as a composer, I prefer people thinking creatively. So I'm creating, I am commissioning and working with sound artists to create nonsense variations. So the first one was just finished recently. It's still internal. So, but the idea is, if you take Minia Manaya, which was my first nonsense piece, it's an a cappella piece. But if you have, let's say, 10 variation tracks, one of which is big drums, another totally atmospheric, another one kitchen utensils, you know, another one totally dubstep, things like that. And as long as you get a one sheet saying, hey, here's what changes from the original, you know, wait 4 beats instead of 8 beats here before you come back in, you'll hear it in the track. Or you wait 8 bars before you come in instead of starting right away, That's all you need. And then you just know the original, but it fits in to this larger soundscape. It's going to make high schoolers and college age people and community choruses and anyone else think, wait a second, this piece is alive. It's not fixed. It's not dead. Just because it's published doesn't mean we're not done thinking creatively with it, right? Which variation do we want to do? How do we want this piece to sound? And it takes the onus off of us reimagining what that piece would be and just allowing the piece to explore itself in a new sound environment.
Yeah. And just, right? You know, everything that you're talking about, you know, singers being able to really be, they have the opportunity to have to play a larger part in that creative process rather than just kind of sitting them, like, you know, kind of like you said, sitting there with a score in front of them and, we're just kind of following directions. It's like, wait, I don't have to follow directions? Wait.
Or you find this kind of middle ground where I can follow directions. It's accessible. It's feasible for me to do that, but it's also acknowledging that the world around me is changing.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's the hope, is that I think this is going back to what we were talking about, I think before we even started this, where I was talking about how the pandemic has helped, I think, a lot of people press a reset button, or at least remind themselves, you know, like, I don't have to care about absolutely everything in the world. Like, what are the real reasons why I'm doing what I'm doing? You know, George Floyd and that whole situation, I think helped a lot of people realize that they weren't doing enough in some ways, including me. And this focus on creative literacy and creative engagement and helping people feel empowered to be their own artist, just as much as enjoying the art around them, is actually a direct result of me realizing that I was not being enough of an advocate for the Black community and for other communities. I myself am a white heterosexual man in America. You know, like, there are a lot of people that have not benefited from the benefits that I have in the world. And to me, I think that that's the same for us in the arts and creative spaces. We are not necessarily offering enough creative space for people to realize their own brilliance, you know? And so the hope is that these types of projects, consortia, the creative literacy clinics, the nonsense variations, that ideally I'm in my own little way trying to help people realize that they can be creative in almost every avenue and think outside the box about what matters to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it's the types of things that you're doing. It's like I think you said earlier, it's changing the game. And it's really having such a huge impact on just choral music and what we think choral music is and how it can relate to our singers here in, you know, this day and age, but also continuing to give our students, our singers, opportunities that they don't have, but also just a wider variety of opportunities and just expanding their view of music and expanding their view of the world too. Like, it's having such a greater impact than just notes on a page. So
that's the hope.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Paul, before I let you go, tell people where they can find you and all of these amazing things that you're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. My website is just my full name, pauljohnrudoy.com. And then you can reach me at paul@pauljohnrudoy.com anytime. Yeah. Simple.
Terrific. Terrific. Well, thank you so much, not only for just being here with me today, but for creating all of these wonderful opportunities for singers in this world of choral music. You're just doing fantastic things, and I hope this podcast episode gets the word out about some of these amazing things that you're doing. Thank you for doing the work that you do.
Well, thank you, Matt. And thanks for making this podcast possible. Like, podcasts are a wonderful way for people to connect with some amazing ideas. And so I'm honored to be on.
Well, that's it for my conversation with Paul John Radoy. What an incredible guy. What an incredible musician. Not only is he creating just fantastic choral music, but just doing wonderful things to benefit everyone here in this wonderful choral community. So if you want to find out more about Paul and his work, you can go to pauljohnrudoy.com and also his consortio project, consortio.io. And I will be sure to put both of those links in the show notes for you. And if you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you hit subscribe, share this episode with your friends, and if you would, go over and leave the podcast a 5-star rating and review, because that is going to help more choir directors find the podcast and help me in my goal in helping as many choir directors as possible. Well, thanks again for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, and until next time, keep being awesome. Are you looking for resources that will save you time and frustration? Want to dive deeper into topics related to your teaching? Then check out the Choir Director Corner community membership over at choirdirectorcorner.com/membership.